Welcome back to the Behind the Wings podcast, produced by Wings Over the Rockies Air and Space Museum in beautiful Denver, Colorado. We've got a lot to explore. Today, in celebration of National Volunteer Month, we're excited to speak with Wings Over the Rockies volunteer Phil Mentisana. Phil tells us personal stories about his time as an electronic warfare officer on the B-52, flying the F-4 in Vietnam, and well, just join us for the full interview to hear Phil's many great stories. It's time to go Behind the Wings. I'm your host, Rick Crandall, and I've been fascinated by space for as long as I can remember.
3, 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff.
And with me is my co-host, retired fighter pilot and Wings Over the Rockies CEO, John Barry. Stay with us because this one is going to be cool. Let's get started. Phil Mentisana, welcome to the show. To start off, could you introduce yourself?
Phil Mentisana is my name. I joined the Air Force way back before y'all were born in 1958. It was a program called Aviation Cadets, and went through that. And I did 21 years in the Air Force, flew the T-38s, flew the B-52s in training, and that was actually the one out front, probably, because they only had 14 of them at Castle Air Force Base, and we flew about 14 or 15 missions in training there, so I might have owned that airplane. Then went to Mather. After that, went T-38s in pilot training, stayed as an IP. Flew F-4s after that, and then came back and flew T-38s again with the Germans this time. And then after that, I took a job that I knew I was going to retire, so I took a job as the Air Force rep to the FAA and retired from that in Fort Worth because I was from Dallas. Totally after that, I went to work for United Airlines and flew everything they owned.
That's an amazing career, Phil. So before we get into the specifics of flying, tell me what really excited you about flying and what stands out for you, you know, when you tell people about your history?
First thing that excited me, the whole thing to get me into the Aviation Cadet program, I went bowling one night with a friend of mine, and there was this big brochure out there and had a B-47 on the front of it and said, join the Air Force. And that's what got me in. I had flown one time in my life before with my best friend's girlfriend's father, who had a twin Bonanza, and took me up, and I thought that was kind of fun. But cadets, you got really interested in flying because we started out down at Lackland. The airplanes would be flying over us all the time, and that's the only time they allowed us to look up. They said, look up, gaze, you know, and we would gaze at the airplane. So that got me excited, and then once it's got you, it doesn't let go.
That's true.
All right, I know the brochure at the bowling alley. I know that piqued your interest, but what was it that set you?
That's a very good question. And I mean, I wanted to be a pilot, and I'm an EW sitting in the back of a B-52. That really wasn't what I was looking for. And until I got into pilot training, my days in SAC were not my favorite time, to be honest with you. One thing is, I mean, SAC, you would have think you'd be home a lot, and I spent a lot of time away from my family in SAC. As a matter of fact, about two or three of the B-52 flights were very long, some of them 25 hours. We'd all take breaks. We still only had the 6 crew members, so we still only had 2 pilots. It wasn't like the airlines where they put an extra one on board. When the aircraft commander was taking the break, the co-pilot let me fly the B-52, take it off autopilot, and I'd fly. And, you know, for a few minutes. And he didn't let me do very much, but stayed real close to me. But I, you know, by then I was hooked.
It wasn't your favorite thing sitting in the back of the B-52, but you did.
Yes, I did.
And people should know what that role, I mean, it's you were doing important stuff back there. You weren't just back there being angry at the Air Force. You were, there was stuff going on.
Yes, there was.
And so for folks that maybe don't know what an electronic warfare, what is that?
You're a rated navigator, but you're not navigating. You're sitting in front of a bunch of electronic jammers and electronic receivers. And you sit back there, and your mission is to keep basically missiles and bad stuff from hitting the airplane that they're using radars to guide it there. And as a matter of fact, you also, we tried to jam the enemy fighters. We would practice with F-102s and F-106s coming up and practice jamming their radar, and they'd be practicing intercepting bombers. So that was the deal, to listen for the signature of radars and then to jam that radar.
You're in the B-52, you're flying as an EO, but now you're flying in combat. You're over in Vietnam getting ready for ArcLight. Maybe tell us a little bit about what year was that, and then also the fact that you were one of the first B-52s to be able to be engaged in combat in Vietnam. Tell us a story about that.
We were the first, actually. The ArcLight mission was started in February of 65, and the target we were going to go over and bomb was Phu Kien Air Base, which is very close to Hanoi. When that one took off, the plan was, it was SAC again, and they had it planned to the second when you would take off, and everything planned to the second when you would hit the tanker. That was really important because we took off and we flew into a typhoon, and it was dark when we flew into the typhoon, and we flew past the Philippines and we were getting to the tanker. Now we flew three ship formations in that one, so we had 30 airplanes flying three ship formations, so 10 cells 1 mile apart flying these formations, and we're going to hit our refueling tanker in this typhoon. And the lead aircraft, which was in the cell ahead of us, got there early. And he decided that he would do a 360-degree turn to kill some time so he would be on time at the tanker. Well, he did a 360-degree turn into all of us in trail behind him. And he hit the cell behind us. Two airplanes were lost, six people in each airplane. About four or five survived. The rest of them all were fatal.
You've flown to Vietnam, you've got combat time as an EWO, and now you get a chance to go to pilot training. Tell us a little bit about your experience in pilot training, what airplanes you flew there, but also, why'd you pick the F-4?
They held us after the ArcLight missions. They held us continuing to fly ArcLight missions. A bunch of my friends had all the EWs applied for pilot training, every one of us, I think. And they had an age limit, and I think it was, you couldn't be in pilot training if you were over 27, if I'm not mistaken. What happened were a couple of my buddies were a year older than me, and we all passed the test and then would have to take it again the next year and pass it again the next year as a Stanine test or whatever they called it. And they would only take the ones that were approaching the age limit. So I got to stay until I was coming up on 27. And I held up my hand and I said, hey guys, I've been approved for pilot training. I'm sitting over here in Guam. Oh no, SAC's giving you a waiver. You can go in after you're 27 because you got to stay your 30 days over here. So I was a little older than I was allowed to go in because I had a waiver. So I went over, I did pilot training, went to Laughlin, Del Rio. And
that's where I went to pilot training too.
Oh, did you? Yeah, okay. Yeah. So went through Laughlin, I say T-41s, T-37s, a tweet, and then into the T-38s, which was a supersonic. Being a captain when I went in, made it a piece of cake. I mean, all the other guys were ROTC guys coming in. I was a major by this time, and I volunteered to go back, and it turns out my two buddies that were captains and now were coming up on being majors too, they weren't majors yet. We all asked for F-4s, and I got an F-4 because they needed some rank in the squadrons over there. They were getting nothing but lieutenants and captains, and they usually had a LC for the squadron commander, and the next guy down the list was probably a captain. So I got the F-4.
So you complete your training with the F-4, one right here behind you looking at you. You went back to Vietnam. You ended up flying 216 combat missions?
Yeah.
That seems like a big number.
It seemed like it to me.
It did. And it was.
Yeah, you know? it was a lot. But some of the, you've got to put that in perspective. You really do. I had 216 combat missions. Probably 30 or 40% of those were in North Vietnam. That was in Route Pack 6. That was hot. We flew in Cambodia. We flew in Laos. We flew in South Vietnam. As a matter of fact, the first 6 months that I was in Vietnam, I had dropped a bomb in every country in Southeast Asia save one. I had never been to South Vietnam. And so of those 216, there's different ones.
100 missions usually was the time where you got sent back home.
Yeah.
So how did you get 216 out of it?
Well, it's been a year, and we sometimes, some of our missions, we would fly six a day. We had a Da Nang turn. We would fly from Ubon, where I was going, we'd fly a mission, land at Da Nang, arm up again, fly a mission, fly back to Da Nang, arm up again, fly a mission, come back to Da Nang. After the last mission was back to Ubon again, and they were through for the day. You flew four or five missions a day. So, I mean, some of the ones were really exciting, noteworthy missions.
So I'm sitting in front of this F-4, pretty impressive looking aircraft. What was that like to fly?
It was a lot of fun to fly. It's my favorite airplane. The fact that I'm still here talking to you alone makes it my favorite airplane. To give you one kind of funny story, the airplane is capable of supersonic. With bombs hanging all over and everything, you can go Mach 1 at a blink of an eye. That's not a problem. You can go faster than the speed of sound. But the airplane's capable of Mach 2.3. In training, I don't know if they did this when you went through, but you had one mission that you went up and got the absolute maximum speed you could get with the airplane. I went out to get in the airplane, and it was freshly painted, new airplane. It just looked like it came right out of the factory, but it was an old airplane. And you flew this special profile, and you flew the profile where you climbed and descended and climbed and descended, and in the last descent, the airplane was going the maximum speed it would go. And I was up to 1,100 and some odd knots. But in miles per hour, that was over 1,450 miles an hour. So I get the airplane, I bring it back, coming into the parking place, and the crew chief is waving me in to park, and I stopped and I'm looking at his face, and I can tell that he is PO'd about something. I mean, he's mad about something. And I climb out, and I'm thinking, why? I mean, brought all the parts you sent me with back. I mean, that ought to be pretty good. I got out and I found out why. His airplane had just come out of the paint shop, going 1,400 miles an hour, peeled every bit of paint off of the fuselage of that airplane. And actually, we had our squadron emblem on the front of it. It was a different squadron emblem because we got it from a different squadron, so it was going back to the paint shop. So that was how it feels.
You know, you described how you get to Mach 2, and it's called the Ratowski climb. People think you could just kind of, you know, climb it in your supersonic. No, the F-4 couldn't do that at time. F-16s could do that later on, but, you know, but you really had to do this thing and get up there and then finally get through the Mach and get to Mach 2.
When I went through F-4 training, we spent 6 months going through RTU, and I think I had two missions that were BFM missions, which are called basic fighter maneuver missions, dogfighting. I had two missions out of all of them. The rest of it was all sitting in class watching how you should do things. We had a horrible, horrible record in Vietnam fighting MiGs, very bad. And to embarrass the Air Force even further, the Navy had a better record than we had. They've changed things a lot. And the Air Force today is not the Air Force that I loved, but it just wasn't learning to fight air to air. Now, fortunately, that wasn't my mission. My mission, my specialty was laser guided bombs, which we have one here in the museum. I had a chance at one MiG. I had come in a laser guided bomb, flight of four. I'm leading the fight back to the tanker. And just before we leave bad guy country and going over to hit the tanker, making a turn, I look down and there's a MiG turning right in behind me. And I turn back at him, and as soon as I do, he goes this way and dives away from us. He was painted white. And the MiG goes down, and I'm looking at my fuel, and I'm looking at the tanker, and I'm thinking, you know, what number four's fuel like? Because mine's not really bad low, but it's low, and number four is always lower than you are. So I thought, hey, I've had enough of this, and we go to the tanker. I've been kicking myself in the rear for years that I had one chance at a MiG and I didn't take it. We found out later in Vietnam that the MiG, this was a 17 by the way, the MiG 17s had a routine where they would have a wagon wheel of MiG 17s circling low. They would have one suck you in, and as you followed him, he would go through that wagon wheel, and this always would be somebody at your six then. Why was that airplane painted white? I think there's a reason he was painted white. That probably was a good move on my part.
All right, so, you know, one of the missions I want you to tell us a little bit about is when Operation Linebacker, and, you know, what it meant to be, you know, you're going to have to slow, you know, transportation supply routes and take them out and all that other. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Okay, well, linebacker, we had to send an airplane about once a month to Taiwan to get modifications made to the airplane. And so you flew the airplane up and came back commercial. And we'd pick a different guy to do it every month. Well, it was my turn in May. I took that airplane up there. And I'm coming back. We had two or three days off to run around Taiwan and came back on a 130 ultimately to Ubon. And I was ready to just go back to work just because I was the ops officer of the squadron. My truck comes down to pick me up and I'm ready to get in the truck. And the guy says, hurry, I'm getting the truck, Major. He says, we got a briefing in 10 minutes. I said, what? He says, we're going to Hanoi. I said, what? And so I get in the truck and we go out there and we brief linebacker one. It's going to be that day. And by the way, you're going to lead the chaff flight in. And so we had two flights that were going to come in. We were going to drop what we call chaff bombs. Okay, and then the strike force was going to come in. These chaff bombs are going to create a cloud of chaff. For a better way to describe it, it used to be tinfoil. It's not anymore, but it's like tinfoil. So it'd be like tinfoil confetti in the air, and it kind of hides from radar because it reflects very well into radar. It kind of hides the airplanes, not entirely, but kind of. So we're going to go in and we're going to drop a chaff bomb every 30 seconds from the initial point to Hanoi. And we had two flights of four. As we turned in and started dropping the bombs, the ceiling kept getting lower and lower and lower. So we kept descending and the chaff flight was going to go down, and then the strike flight that's coming in behind us has to be even lower. And we're dropping our bombs, and we had a system that would detect SAMs. And it was a little round scope and it had a little red light under it. This light would strobe at where the SAM radar was tracking you. So if somebody was tracking you over here, then you had a strobe over there. And when they launched the SAM, they had to guide the SAM by data link. And so we could pick up the data link signal going to the airborne SAM, and a light came on that says launch. So you had a strobe SAM towards it, and then there's a red light SAM, there's a SAM coming at you. It was totally useless in linebacker. There were SAMs everywhere, airborne, so the red light was on all the time, and there were strobes all the way around you because SAMs were tracking you all the time. So that was totally useless. So you had to visually identify them, which is the way you avoided them anyway. We had a maneuver we flew in. It was called take it down. You got the SAM above you pointed down so that the SAM would accelerate to close to Mach 3, and then that you would watch it coming towards you. When you couldn't stand it anymore, you'd pull up right into the SAM. And as you pulled up into the SAM, the aircraft has got very large flight controls relative to the SAM missile. And so as you pull up, you can pull up pretty steeply. The SAM missile stalls as it's trying to go and goes off under you. That's how we have avoided them. And you would hear all the time somebody yelling, take it down, you know. So we're going in, dropping our MiG bombs, and everything's going fine to about halfway up. Backseater yells, MiGs, MiGs. I said, where? 12 o'clock. I said, those are SAMs. I've got them. And so I had two SAMs going up straight in front of us. About that time, my number four guy, High Test 4, saved my life. He says, High Test lead, take it down, take it down. And I looked, and there's three rear view mirrors and the canopy bow of the F-4. The left rear view mirror, when I looked at it, was full of SAM. The SAM was so close to us, I could see the canards, the guiding fins on the SAM moving to guide towards us. I'll never forget that SAM. And there wasn't any take it down to it. It was there. And so I just pulled up and it went off right here. The frag pattern on a SAM was built to shoot up at B-52s. So the frag pattern went down and away from me. So we didn't get any damage. However, it went off so close that it rolled the airplane with the explosive blast next to us. So we were up here and the rest of my flight were out here somewhere because we all scattered, you know, and we had to get them all back together. In that 15 minutes it took us to fly from the initial point to Hanoi, the eight airplanes, we had 14 SAMs fired at us in 15 minutes. So that was linebacker one.
And only one airplane got damaged, you said?
Only one airplane got damaged.
Wow. We're going to change course, and this is going to slow down a whole bunch because we're going to talk about United now. And I've always wanted to ask one of you fighter guys who then got out of the service and went to work for the airlines. That's a whole different kind of flying.
It is, but not any less enjoyable. Not any less enjoyable at all. My favorite two airplanes, the F-4 and the 777. At that time, absolute state of the art. Marvelous airplanes. And you prided, instead of dropping bombs, you prided yourself on what kind of landing can I make? Can I have somebody have to call the tower to see we're on the ground, you know? If you did that kind of landing, you had a good day.
Yeah. You flew them all for United. What was the first one?
I was qualified in the 727, 737, 747, 757, 767, 777, and DC-10. I didn't fly the 787, which is current, which it came out after I retired. And I had a very short career. That was all in 13 years.
Okay, Phil, when did you get out of the Air Force, and then what preceded that?
I got out of the Air Force in 79, and I was Lieutenant Colonel. When I got out of the airplane, I was 39 years old. The age to get hired by an airline, max, was 37. I applied to everybody. I mean, everybody. I had a stack this high I applied to. Most of them didn't even bother to answer, and those that did said no thanks. And so I was 10 years as a vice president of a commercial construction company, and I had a Bonanza, and I kept flying my Bonanza and wishing I was flying a 737 or something. And by the way, of all the airplanes flying, the 777 was my favorite, but the one that was almost my favorite was the 37 because it flew more like a fighter than any of the rest of them.
So you aged out on going to pilot training and had to get a waiver, and then you aged out for getting into airlines, but you still managed to get it. That's pretty good.
Well, yeah, it was. I've found in my life there's something to be said for perseverance.
That's right.
And if you and that's what I tell kids coming through here. I've had many people coming through here that want to go to the airlines or want to go to the Air Force, and they're just starting. And they see this long thing, and I tell them, persevere, man. You've just got to keep knocking on the door till somebody lets you in.
When you had the chance, when you heard that the airlines had opened up to older and you were now qualified, right? Had a conversation with your wife.
Yes. I had aced out because I was too old for the airlines. I'm a member of a fighter pilot organization. We have conventions every year. One was in Washington, D.C., and the Medal of Honor medal had just been approved. Reagan was president. And he invited us all out to the White House. And we went out there, and I got in the bus to go out with these guys. My wife and I, and they were there with us, and they're all my age. Now, I'm 49. I'm not 39. I'm 49 now. And they're all switching airlines. And I said, you guys can't be doing that. You are too old to be doing that. And they said, oh, no, man, the rules have changed. Come on in. The rules are fine. You know, the weather's fine. Come on in. So we get back to the hotel room that night. My wife started out the conversation with, well, are you going to apply again? And I said, I don't think so. I said, rejection is hard. And I said, I went through everybody and was rejected. And I said, I just don't know that I can handle that again. And she said, well, I'll tell you what. She said, I've been listening to you for 10 years, and I won't use the word, what she said.
Yeah.
It starts with a B, about not getting hired with the airlines. And she said, so either you try again, or shut up, I don't ever want to hear again that you miss getting hired by the airlines. And she said, and not only that, but I know you'll get hired. And if you do, you owe me anything I want. So I knew I couldn't shut up, so I applied. And United hired me, and not only was I fortunate enough to get in as a pilot, I was also fortunate enough to get in as an instructor, so I taught the 747. And so I go back to it right after I got hired, and I said, what is it? New ring, new house, you know, new car? What are we doing here? And she said, I'll tell you what. She said, I want you to enjoy every minute you have with United Airlines. Said, when you retire from United, she said, aviation has been good to you your whole life. She said, you figure out some way to give back. I'm doing that right now.
Well, you know, that's a great transition to, you know, first of all, thank you for all you do here at the museum, and it's amazing. The other thing, too, is that we can't run museums, all of us, anywhere in the country, without volunteers. But with your experience and with your history and your ability to tell stories, I mean, it's just marvelous. I mean, I walk around, I see people around you all the time. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for taking this time to tell us your story. And certainly thank you for all that you do for us in the museum.
Well, thank you for having me.
If we were in the time machine, you could go back and do it all over again, you would, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. The only thing I would do different is I would start out younger. When I got out and was pilot trained, I had a 4-year commitment. It's now a 12-year commitment. However, there's a caveat to that. You can join the reserve and fly for the airlines and still fulfill your 12-year commitment. If I had to do over again, that's the route I would take.
Last question I'll ask you. You touched on it a minute ago. I'm going to have you expand on it a little bit. And it's about, you know, maybe young people that are listening to this podcast or others that wonder about getting into a career in aviation. Advice for them. You said perseverance. You repeated it a couple of times. That word is so important to you. Persevere in their effort to get into aviation. But what other advice would you give them?
You don't really know whether you've got a strong feeling for aviation unless you get in it. My feeling is if you're considering it and considering it strongly, go on and start somewhere. You can start by getting a private pilot's license. You can start seeing John down at Exploration of Flight. You've got all kinds of programs for that. Once you get started, it gets more expensive as you go along. However, even the airlines now are recognizing that they need pilots, and so they're helping you pay for some of your training nowadays. When I got my ATP, which is Airline Transport Pilot rating, I got it on my own. Just getting that rating cost me $3,000 or $4,000 in 1960 money. And nowadays, you can find somebody who'll help you do that. So if you've got the inkling, put your foot in the water, test it, see if you like it, because you might. I think a very large amount of you will.
Well, great job, Phil.
Boy, thank you to Phil Minasani. And there were so many interesting takeaways from that. I particularly loved the part about linebacker. I was really fascinated by the history. You know, being a young airman right after Vietnam, I knew the name Arclight. I knew the name linebacker. But to hear it from somebody who was so intimately involved with it, that was fascinating. What were your takeaways, John?
So, you know, I know he talked about the B-52, but when he started talking about the F-4, it flashbacks for me on so many different levels. We went to the same pilot training school, although it was like 6 years of difference between us. But what a great storyteller. And, you know, that is what he's so good about here at the museum. So I think it was a trip down memory lane for me, but it was just an awesome story.
Well, that'll do it, folks. Hope you enjoyed episode 35. I can't believe we're into those numbers already, of the Behind the Wings podcast. Thanks for listening. Be sure to visit wingsmuseum.org/podcast, okay, to join the conversation and access the show notes. I'm telling you, the show notes are amazing, so you'd like to be making that part of your experience with this. And also make sure to head over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen and subscribe. While you're at it, be sure to leave a review. It's the best way for a lot more folks to find out about us and start joining us here. And we greatly appreciate hearing from you. Hey, we'll see you next time right here on Behind the Wings.